So, as I think you all know, we've been doing a series on practicing with what I've been calling the emotions we don't want to have, the difficult, the painful emotions. And we've talked about anger, we've talked about fear and shame, and tonight we're going to talk about grief. Here's a verse. For grief has darkened my eyes. My body is like a shadow. My days fade like an echo. The strings of my heart have snapped. Any guesses where that's from? It's from the Bible. That's from the book of Job. It's Job. If you don't know the story, I won't tell it at any length, but Job lost one thing after another. He lost pretty much everything in his life. His health, his wealth, his loved ones. For grief has darkened my eyes, my body is like a shadow. My days fade like an echo. The strings of my heart have snapped. It's a pretty vivid description of acute grief, don't you think? It feels like our heart is broken. Feels like we don't know who we are anymore. Grief is an emotion, I think, of any of these that I've been studying for a very long time, probably since before I was aware that I was studying it. And the reason for that is that I was raised by a bereaved mother. My mom lost her mother when she, my mother, was 12, and then 3 years later, her dad died, working two jobs, trying to take care of his five children during the Great Depression in the 30s. He was a house painter by day, and then he moonlighted as a railroad switch operator. He had a massive stroke in the little box that he sat in. At the railroad switch. And my mother remembers to this day listening through the heat vent above the kitchen as all the aunts and uncles sat around the kitchen table dividing up the children, the five children. And she remembers one uncle saying, "Well, I guess we'll take Margaret." That was her. So throughout my childhood, I observed, you know how children observe the adult world. Like, what's going on? What's going on? Why can't my mother and her sisters understand and accept each other? They were raised through adolescence by three different people, for one thing. Why was my mother so angry at me when I reached adolescence, those years when she was without her mother? It took me years to start connecting the dots and having insight into my mother. But then, in my early 20s, two couples, good friends, each lost a young child. One in a sudden accident, and the other to a five-year course of leukemia. And these deaths affected me very deeply. And I observed the two couples. One couple who didn't survive as a couple, but who each remarried and made a good life for themselves. The other couple who survived as a couple, but withdrew socially, became very isolated, broke off all connection with their friends. So I watched these events and these impacts on my friends with a sense of helplessness and with a questioning, you know, a sense of questioning, how do people go on? How do people survive when the worst happens? You know, death of a child being one of the worst possible things. I read some of the early literature, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying. I thought about becoming a hospice volunteer, but I didn't really move in that direction until 1990. My younger sister died of a very extremely aggressive lymphoma, and she was only 35. And I spent 5 of the 7 months that took with her, very, like, on a daily basis, very close. We were very close during that time. And it was a life-changing time, experience for me. And I knew I had to learn more about what in Zen we call the great matter of life and death. So I did become a hospice volunteer, and then later I came back on staff as a counselor, working mostly with individuals and families who had experienced the death of a loved one. And I feel very privileged to have been part of their lives at such a time. You know, when that happens, we're very kind of stripped down, very vulnerable. Often people have a transparency. Their defenses are down at times like that. And so it's a very, it felt like a privilege, really. And I learned so much from working with children, teens, young adults, and right through the lifespan of people that I worked with. To lose someone we love is the most heartrending experience of impermanence that we have. I feel like I've had many Dharma conversations in my hospice work with people who had no idea that we were having Dharma conversations. People of all ages and religions and walks of life. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful to all those folks who shared their life experience with me, and some of what I'll say will come from that experience. So, definitions. Grief, we could say, is a natural reaction to being separated from who or what we love and need. The word bereave, to be bereaved, derives from the same root as rift or rent, to be split open, to have what we love torn away from us. We feel as though our hearts are broken. It's well known that many animals grieve, particularly those who form close pair bonds or family bonds or social group bonds. Have you ever seen an animal grieve? Yeah. No doubt they do. And grieving is the way we heal from those losses. It's the way we reorient ourselves to the new reality, and both reconnect to the world and form a kind of ongoing inner relationship to who or what we've lost. Mourning, on the other hand, is the way we express our grief externally. So grieving is our inner experience, and mourning is our expression of it. And mourning is quite variable, depending on our temperament, our personality, our gender conditioning, our cultural conditioning, right? Some cultures mourn very loudly and expressively, and some, you know, the British stiff upper lip don't show your feelings. So mourning is very variable. And our culture tells us, our cultures tell us the appropriate way to be when we're, or to express our grief. I don't know if you remember a day or two after 9/11, President George Bush urged everyone to get back to business as usual and go out and shop. Don't let on we're scared, that we're grieving, that we're shattered. Go out and shop. What does this tell us about American culture? But our culture too, let's not just point fingers south of the border, our culture too basically communicates to us that we should get over it in a few days or a few weeks or a few months. And if we take too long, we're being self-indulgent or negative, or if not pathological. So I think it's really important that we not use Buddhist teachings to suppress natural feelings of grief. Like, look, everything's impermanent. Get over it. You could say, isn't that essentially what the Buddha himself told his faithful attendant, Ananda? There's a wonderful scene in the account in the sutras of the Buddha's death, when Buddha comes upon Ananda weeping, anticipating the Buddha's death, and the Buddha says, "Ananda, do not sorrow, do not lament. Have I not told you that there is separation and parting and division from all that is dear and beloved? How could it be that what is born and come to being, formed and bound to fall, should not fall? That is not possible." So the Buddha is kind of saying that to Ananda. But that's not all he's saying. And consider that the Buddha and Ananda had been together for decades. They're very dear, close friends. So the Buddha is saying this very lovingly. But he goes on to say to Ananda, "You have served me faithfully and practiced so sincerely. Please continue and you will become enlightened." And he also says, "You may think, Ananda, the word of the teacher is a thing of the past. Now we have no more teacher. But you should not regard it so. The Dharma and the practice I have taught you are your teacher after I am gone." So the Buddha is very lovingly and carefully preparing Ananda for his death and saying, you know, you will have an inner teacher even after I am gone. So imagine if our partings from our loved ones came at the end of their long, full lives with such careful preparation. We can imagine that our grief might be more gentle, less wrenching, if the partings were like that. But of course, they're not always like that, are they? Sometimes our losses, well, there's so many different ways they come. And sometimes they're sudden, even violent, sometimes prolonged and exhausting. So the path of our grieving is different for each loss. But first, we must admit that we do grieve and not judge ourselves when we do, or take on the judgments we might receive externally. There's an old Zen story I love about a laywoman named Satsujo, who was a disciple of Hakuin Zenji, who was a very fierce Japanese Rinzai Zen master. And she had studied with him for decades. She was an old woman at this point, and she was really highly regarded as a Zen practitioner. But her neighbor came upon her weeping at the death of her little granddaughter. And the neighbor said, "Well, I thought Zen Master Hakuin gave you the seal of enlightenment. What are you blubbering like that for?" And she said, she was quite a feisty lady, and she said, "You idiot. My tears are worth more than 1,000 boring sutras. When I weep for my granddaughter, I weep for every child who has died too young." So she was able to express her grief and with a sense of connectedness to all others who have ever grieved for a child. So those of you who have been here for at least one other of these sessions, some of you have been here for several and some of you may not, may remember we've talked about three ways of practicing with these difficult and painful emotions: attending, befriending, and surrendering. So when we're in a state of grieving, first we have to build our capacity to attend to our experience, not to turn away, and to witness our own experience as it changes moment to moment, day to day, in our bodies and minds and in our behavior. And as we do that, we befriend our experience. We meet it without judgment, with kindness and with patience. I'm going to read you a poem. How many people know the poet Mary Oliver? Yeah, a few. She wrote this book called Thirst after the death of her beloved life partner of 40 years, Molly Malone Cook. And this poem she calls Heavy. It's about not turning away. "That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still, I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, said, 'It's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief. It's all in the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down.' So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire, admire, admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply." So that's her poem about carrying, holding her own grief. And that's what we need to do. We need to be able to hold our pain with very generous, spacious arms, and to attend to it. So when you've been feeling grief, how does it feel in the body? What does grief feel like in the body? Anybody remember from a time that you've been deeply sad what it feels like in the body?
Really heavy.
Yeah, where? Where do you feel it?
I usually feel it in my stomach.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Constricting.
Often people would say a sense of not being able to take a full breath. constriction there.
Like, yeah. There's a lot of pressure on my chest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Almost like verging on the feelings of a panic attack. C.S. Lewis, you know, the writer, fiction writer, and also kind of a theologian, I think he was, wrote a book called A Grief Observed, which chronicled the first year after his wife's death. And it's one of the most eloquent literary descriptions of grieving that I've ever read. And he wrote, "No one ever told me that grief felt so much like fear. I'm not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I keep on swallowing." So these are all physical manifestations. He continues, "At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There's a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. Yeah? I find it hard to take in what anyone says. Or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It's so uninteresting. Yet, I want others to be around me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me." Over and over, I would hear this from people who would come to talk. And people would say, "When I'm alone, I want somebody to be there, but when I'm around people, I want to be alone." It's very paradoxical. Yeah. What feelings go with grieving, besides the obvious sadness?
I think there's a link between grieving and despair. And I think grief generally is, it can be a trauma. Mm-hmm. And you can deal with grief, sometimes the way you deal with trauma, by immersing yourself and examining it. And perhaps the more familiar you become, just as you've said, the less intense are the feelings. Despair, I think, can be addictive. You can wallow in it, in luxury. And you can stay in it an awfully long time. And when that occurs, the other thing you said was some people tend to behave as though there's nothing wrong. And often that is part, sometimes that is part of it, you know, in the sense that attitude change frequently follows behavior change. But it's all degrees and it's all circumstance. Anyway, that's, I've dealt with grief.
Mm-hmm. So definitely despair is one.
Despair is a big one.
So what we see, the more we look at these various emotional states, is how they kind of interpenetrate, right? How about anger? Mm-hmm. Yeah, very strong sometimes, right? In different ways. It could be anger at the doctor who didn't catch the diagnosis sooner, or the drunk driver, or the person themselves. How could you leave me? Yeah.
Relief with somebody who's been sick.
Absolutely. Relief.
Pain.
Yeah. Yeah. After a long period of suffering, relief. And then there's that pang of, oh, how can I feel relieved? Yeah. So that, yeah.
And guilt at stopping grieving?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is actually, that's a nice kind of segue into something else that I wanted to say, is when we first start healing from a loss, and you know, there are times when it just feels relentless. Never, it's always, you know, always in our mind from the moment we wake up in the morning to the evening that, you know, it would last. And then in our dreams, for that matter. But we often start getting kind of brief openings for a moment or 15 minutes or even an afternoon. We become absorbed in life. Something really engages us fully and we forget our pain, and then we feel like we've somehow betrayed the person, that we've forgotten them. And this guilt. Yeah, so guilt can come in any number of ways. Anxiety, loneliness, irritability. There's just so many different feelings and textures. And bringing a kind of more articulated awareness to that can actually be quite helpful, because it just opens up some space. It seems less relentless and more nuanced and less lonely, because especially speaking these experiences can bring a sense of connection to others. The other thing to say about grief is that it's not neat and tidy. It continues to spiral. You know, it's not neat and tidy steps. Despite the model that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross put forward years ago of denial, anger, depression, acceptance, I'm skipping one.
Anger.
Those are aspects, and we may or may not experience all of them, and they certainly may or may not come in an orderly fashion. I remember one woman saying to me, well, I can go through all of those within 1 minute. But what does happen is loss comes up, I think, spirals back throughout our life for integration again and again at different levels as we mature and go through different life stages ourselves. So if we lose a parent early in life, we'll revisit that loss when we become a parent, for example, or when, you know, when we graduate, and then when we become a parent, and then when we reach the age that our parent was when they died. That's often a tough year for people. So we cycle back through these experiences and integrate them again and again through our lives. But the life force is strong, and we do come back to life. Change, we're forever altered by our experiences of loss. And yet, if we attend to our hearts, we can come through loss wiser and more compassionate people, with gratitude for the lives and the loves that we have and have had. Just to take a moment to recognize, of course, that there are many other kinds of loss. When we think of grief, usually we think first of grieving for loved ones. But what are some of the other kinds of loss that we experience grief for?
Jobs.
Yeah.
Friendships.
Friendships, jobs.
Change.
Like?
Relationships ending.
Yeah. Moving. Yeah. You know,
first.
Home.
Health.
I think.
Sorry.
Yeah. Health, and you were saying?
Well, grief for yourself when you don't don't quite turn out the way things should turn out.
Mm. So lost hopes and dreams.
Absolutely, that's a big one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And as we age, you know, there come points when we say, oh, you know, I'm probably not ever going to do that. Yeah.
The wilting flower of youth.
Yes. Our youth, yeah. You know, actually, with each life change, even when we're little kids, and then we start school, we're no longer little kids who don't have to worry about school. We now are kids who go to school. And then when we graduate, that's over, and we enter a new stage. And when we enter a relationship, then we're no longer single people. And so, you know, our life is just, you know, a succession of changes, losing one thing, opening to the next thing, losing and opening. And so, in a sense, the mark of a truly mature person is the ability and the resilience to be able to negotiate life transitions. Because if we collapse with every and can't, you know, with every life transition, we're going to have a really hard life. So building that kind of flexibility and resilience is something that our practice supports us to do. Yeah. Any other?
Pets.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something that's so... when we grieve for our pets, there's something that's kind of pure about it. It's not complicated by all the ambivalences of human relationships. Right, yeah, so there's something very strong about it. Yeah.
I think maybe there's a balance too. I mean, if it's a bit corny, but I think if you live a life where you express kindness as a general principle, when you go through awkward times like grief, somehow or another things balance out more easily. And because you're basically a kind person, you may get more opportunities to get over this more quickly by having people more comfortable with you. I think there's just a balance somehow.
Mm-hmm. There are definitely things that complicate grieving, and earlier traumatic losses can complicate later grieving. You know, and if we've built up, you know, confidence and resilience in our lives, it definitely helps us, yeah, deal with the tragedies that we do encounter. When we've talked about each of these emotions, we've talked about each one having a function. And I think the function of grief is to sort of release that intensity, you know, or and to kind of allow us to kind of be disabled for a little while. Hopefully not for a really extended period, but for a while to be kind of in a disoriented state, and then to reorient ourselves. In many traditional cultures, there's a set period of time where people wear a black armband or wear black, and they're kind of excused from the normal social expectations. Well, they're in mourning, and it's honored, and they can kind of give themselves to that. And then when it's over, it's sort of marked and honored. And we're not very good at that in our culture.
Do you think that's a loss? That there is an advantage to those kinds of cultures where grief is very ritualized?
I think to an extent, yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, the year anniversary is very important. People feel that very strongly. And in our culture, there's nothing to mark that, you know. It's just ordinary day at work, and nobody really notices. And I think a little more, not that we a little more honoring and marking gives a kind of container for those, for the intensity of those feelings. Yeah. So I think culturally we could do a little better job. Yeah. The other thing that we've said with each of these emotions is that each one, when we are able to kind of relax our grip on it and let it go, release it, that's the surrender of attending, befriending, surrendering, that there's a transformed quality when we let go of our intense self-focus with each of these states. And for grief, it's the transformed quality is said to be gratitude. Gratitude, when the intensity eases and we can just hold that loss with a little more sense of sweetness instead of the sharpness of pain, then gratitude arises. And sometimes it's hard won. Sometimes it takes quite a while for that feeling to be there. Back to Mary Oliver. This is a little short, very short poem that she wrote called The Uses of Sorrow. Someone I loved once gave me a box of darkness. It took me years to understand that this too was a gift. Someone I loved once gave me a box of darkness. It took me years to understand that this too was a gift. You know, so sometimes our relationships are fraught and difficult, and when we lose, you know, a relationship with someone who has hurt us, or where there's been unresolved feelings, that doesn't feel much like a gift. And we don't, you know, and yet, over time, we continue to heal our hearts. That's something we can always do. As long as we're alive, we can still heal our hearts. So, I think I'll stop there.